The Catholic bishops of England and Wales this week are encouraging people to use their vote in the forthcoming general election to seek parliamentary candidates who will serve the common good. A message released by the bishops on Tuesday sets out some of the considerations all voters should have in mind when making choices on how to vote, but clearly states the bishops are not advocating any particular party, as that is not their role. The message, which focuses on issues such as family life, migration, the world's poor and protection of the environment, complements a recent document about Catholic social teaching entitled Choosing the Common Good.
It's not about regulation. Regulation's important, but it will never produce a healthy society.
Archbishop Vincent Nicholls of Westminster is president of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. He told me more about the message to voters and a Lenten pastoral letter to Catholics in his own Westminster diocese.
We try to emphasise those qualities of life that are needed if the common good is to be pursued, and which cannot be guaranteed simply by a political decision and process. There are some things that we as citizens and as people together have to ensure, if you like, and guarantee. And we wondered whether we'd slipped into a bit of the mindset that kind of passed over most public and social responsibility to the government, as if to say, well, that's their problem, not ours. So we wanted to lay emphasis on those habits of the heart, of the way people treat each other and understand themselves, that make for civil society. The habits of the heart, of course, are the virtues of prudence and justice and courage and temperance. And we believe that it's these personal qualities that will help to restore trust, because the weakening and at times the breakdown of trust is one of the things that we see at this present time. It's illustrated in the difficulties and scandal around the expenses of members of parliament. It's illustrated in the financial institutions, in the financial crisis that we've been living through. And of course, it has its echoes in the church. But what we're saying is that trust is re-established by good lives when, and this is especially a duty on those in leadership positions. So we echo very much the words of Pope Benedict in Caritas in Veritate when he says that what society needs is, in all its different sectors, leaders who are men and women of integrity and whose consciences are formed and who are committed to the service of the common good. And that's our fundamental appeal and line of argument in the broader document. And then we apply that to a number of areas. And these are the areas that we ask people to follow up in their questioning of MPs. So the overarching question is, does this candidate give you confidence that he will genuinely pursue the common good? Or is this candidate, this woman candidate, is she more interested in particular interests and in using her possible election in a more narrow way? And then in more particular things, we ask about the family, we ask about the importance of marriage, we ask sensitive questions about how candidates would handle issues of immigration, we talk about care for the environment, care for the elderly, and also how a candidate understands the role of religion and of faith communities in a modern society like ours.
You also talk about this pre-election season in a Lenten pastoral letter, don't you, that focuses on, as you say, the need for a more virtuous society. Tell us a bit more about the inspiration behind that.
Well, it obviously, in a pastoral letter, it's addressed to the people and the priests of Westminster Diocese, but it's drawn from that wider document that we made public very broadly a few weeks before. And in the letter, what I tried to illustrate is the contemporary relevance of this traditional language of virtue, and try to say these are the patterns of doing things that slowly we form in ourselves and then help us to act almost instinctively in that way. So prudence, for example, that means how do we approach making a judgment? How do we gain for ourselves what you might call emotional intelligence, so that we're not just reacting to how we feel, but we know how to assess emotion and also think about things in a principled way, and then so come to a prudential judgment, or courage. That's the virtue that helps us not simply to be evasive, not to be hidden, not to, as it were, hide behind this notion that, oh, well, I have a private life and it's nobody else's business. Or the virtue of justice, which is recognizing and honoring the duty we owe to others. And that begins in a family, the duty that children have to their parents, that parents have to their children, to their neighbours. And we're looking just to call people to recognise again that we have to encourage each other to be virtuous, to live good lives. It's not about regulation. Regulation is important, but it will never produce a healthy society. It's like if you think of a football match. The rules have to be kept, but unless there's a virtuoso performance somewhere, which is the fruit of a lot of training, unless there's that spark of virtuosity, then it's a bit tedious and boring. And that's what it is. When we see in people that spark of goodness transformed into habit and action, then they become inspiring for others. So it was taking those virtues, and of course the virtue of temperance, which is maybe, it's described as the key to happy living, or one of the keys to happy living. It's knowing how to use the good things of this world, but not use them to excess, and being able to measure that and to be content and happy with a measure of appreciation of all that is good without spoiling things by excess.
You talk about Lent not being a time for laying blame on others, but for seeking forgiveness and working together for a more just, a happier society. And yet blaming others does seem to be very much part of our culture today, doesn't it? It's a very countercultural message that you're putting forward.
Well, I think it's a message that will also find an echo in many people's hearts, actually, because I think we are all a bit weary of being, as it were, drawn to judge everything that we do by the risk it might entail of somebody else complaining. Because that's not a terribly creative way to live. It's a very defensive way to live. It's a very guarded and, as it were, closed-in way to live. And it comes back, you know, to that question of trust. Do we have enough shared vision about what it means to live a good life that we can trust one another? Or are we forever going to live in an atmosphere of cynicism when we basically believe nobody else is to be trusted and the only way forward is to protect my own interest and to pursue my own understanding of what's good for me? And in a way, the discussion centres around that very choice. And what we say in our document is that there are many reasons for being hopeful, because what we see in emergency moments, in emergency situations, is how generous people are and how much they are prepared to put themselves out at considerable cost to help another who is in greater need. And we're saying that's the instinct which we would like to see consistently shape the culture, the shared life which we lead. That can't be done by politicians. Politicians play their part, but that's why our first appeal is for everyone to look at how they live and how they can contribute positively to the common good.
Finally, you mentioned briefly the loss of trust, not just in politics and financial institutions, but also in the church. The Catholic Church, of course, as a whole at the moment, being blamed very much for the abuse crisis which has engulfed Ireland and other European countries, including the Pope's native Germany. As one of the church leaders there in the UK who was responsible for dealing with a similar crisis there just a few years back, what is your reaction to the current situation?
Well, I'm very saddened and shocked. It is terrible when children are abused and when trust of that intimate nature is betrayed, and then when, for mistaken reasons, attempts are made to cover it up. So I think what we have learned in this country are two key lessons. The first is that the well-being and the safeguarding of children is the first consideration. That is more important than protecting anybody's good name, and that has to come first because of the long-term damage that the abuse of children does. And that's a message which we in the Catholic community in England and Wales have had to learn, but I think every community has to learn it. Civil society has to learn it as well, because in our country at least, you know, the occurrences of the abuse of children is generally speaking, 75% within family life. So the first lesson is that the safety and the protection of children must come first because they are powerless. And the second lesson is, within the church, is that the procedures that we put in place must be open and evidently fair, just. So a witch hunt doesn't help. We have to have procedures which are clearly fair, because otherwise they don't win support, and therefore the culture in which we live doesn't change. But it's a long, hard road. We've worked for 10 years, and I think we've made some progress. We must always be on the alert, and we must always be very, very attentive to the huge harm that abuse in childhood does to a person.
My thanks there to Archbishop Vincent Nicholls of Westminster, President of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And to find out more about the Bishops' general election message and their Choosing the Common Good statement, you can see their website, www.catholicchurch.org.uk.